information while searching online for posters to hang on my bedroom wall. This was a big moment in its own right, since I was finally replacing one of the many bedroom themes I'd had through adolescence. First Pokemon, then Nautica, then Rainforest Cafe. I was ready for the more sophisticated, undefined aesthetic of a trendy college dorm, like the kids on Boy Meets World. This was the 2000s, after all. I'd survived Y2K, and it was time to enhance my bedroom game with a few posters that said, "Hey, if you think this is a kid's room, you can go fuck yourself, because an adult man lives here now, one who likes Lizzie McGuire and NSYNC and American Idol like all grown heterosexuals do." I clicked on a section called College, obviously, because that's the category all mature men shop for their bedroom posters in. I scrolled through endless images of Pink Floyd covers and Bob Marley heads and that one dumb picture of John Belushi from Animal House where he's just standing there with a stupid look on his face, until finally I noticed a subcategory called Hot Girls looming in the corner of the screen and, just beneath it, like the shiny clasp of a treasure chest poking through the surface of a dirty beach, waiting for some lucky explorer to catch its seductive glance, Hot Guys. I hovered over that link for a good 5 minutes. I knew full well that the one above it was what other boys, like my older brother, who already had a picture of a woman in some gaudy animal print bikini hanging on his own wall, would eagerly click without hesitation. But that wasn't what gave me pause. What gave me pause was the gurgling well of Catholic guilt that had been filling my stomach since baptism. My family was never particularly religious, but by some circumstance, we were Catholic, and so, by default, I was sent to Sunday school, where I was taught that anything even vaguely sexual is a sin, and if you even think about sex once in your life, you'll spend eternity personally shining Satan's shoes in hell. Or something like that. I don't really remember specifics, but there are a lot of rules in Catholicism, and most of them go something like this. No smiling, no getting naked, no touching your penis for more than 5 seconds while urinating, no erections, no looking at another person's bare skin, no kissing anybody but your mother and also Jesus, no meat on Fridays during Lent, and no looking at posters on the internet with sinful descriptions like hot. And I was a gullible child, fearful of any semblance of retribution. My cousin once convinced me that Catholic priests could identify when you'd sinned and would smash a raw egg on your head when you approached them during Mass in front of the entire congregation and everything. And I fucking believed that shit for almost an entire week before I realized Catholic priests weren't allowed to touch eggs because they come from bird vaginas. But still, I was scared shitless. The truth is, though, I don't remember any chastising of homosexuality specifically. In Catholic school, all sex is wrong, no matter who it's with. Unless you're a priest, but you know what? I'm not getting into that right now. When I lingered over that hot guys link, I wasn't even thinking all that much about the fact that it was guys, but about the fact that this was an adult thing to do, and something Jesus would probably not like very much. Of course, you know where this is going. I clicked the fucking link. I was 13 and horny. Catholic guilt might be able to convince you you're going to hell, but it can't convince you that looking at dick on the internet isn't worth the journey. When I finally opened that page, after asking Jesus if he would politely look away, it was like Scrooge McDuck sauntering into his vault of money, untying his velvet robe, and skipping the ladder to dive headfirst into his pond of gold. I should note, for the curious, that these were not high-quality posters of hot guys. I remain convinced that no such thing exists, though I'd gladly be proven wrong. These were images of burly, misshapen New York firefighters and the midsections of middle-aged bodybuilders and maybe one half-decent picture of David Beckham. Stuff that most grown women, let alone 13-year-old boys, would find utterly uninteresting and perhaps even repugnant. And yet my tiny, horny, sinful brain flooded with adrenaline and dopamine and all those good feelings that say, if you're looking at a picture of a Latino Chippendale and feeling these things, congratulations, you're a homosexual. Once the door was open, it was like every little thing reaffirmed the inevitable truth. The shirtless gardener on Desperate Housewives, the hot male cheerleader from Bring It On, shopping bags from Abercrombie & Fitch, that picture of Mark Wahlberg and his Calvin Klein's, Ashton Kutcher, the first time I heard a song from Dreamgirls and the first time I voted for Clay Aiken on American Idol, Brendan Fraser in George of the Jungle, and the Batman movie where Robin wears the pointy-nippled suit? Oh, and the time Playgirl published those nude photos of Brad Pitt, which actually happened and wasn't just a concoction of my overstimulated gay brain. Now, most people mistakenly believe children can't possibly know they're gay, that it's absurd for a child to know that a pubescent fancy for Matthew McConaughey in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days will manifest itself in a lifelong pursuit of a strapping Adonis with well-kept facial hair and a loft-style apartment. And I'd be inclined to agree if the signs on my part hadn't always been so glaringly obvious. I mean, sure, if you don't know you're looking for them, maybe the signals are easy to miss, but it's a goddamn mystery I made it as long as I did without a single member of my family raising questions. The evidence? I took a baking class instead of playing baseball because I preferred the safe, delicate art of muffin making to the heterosexual demands of running in sand. I stayed inside on weekends to watch TLC's Trading Spaces and went to the local library after school to borrow multiple volumes of interior design books to scheme my dream Parisian chateau. The most emotion I felt on the day of my first communion was the moment I got a Beanie Baby wrapped in a Backstreet Boys gift bag. I once demanded to be taken to the music store for the sole purpose of purchasing Britney Spears' seminal classic Oops, I Did It Again on compact disc. My favorite toys were a collection of animal dolls called Littlest Pet Shop, which I accessorized to death and kept in a full-size dollhouse, and my favorite Power Ranger was the pink one, which I know isn't gay in and of itself, but considered in context, was pretty damn gay. And yet, my family still claims they had no idea. The problem, I imagine, is that most of my eccentricities could be ascribed to the fact that I was a shy, chubby nerd who didn't like to talk about his feelings. Sure, I never liked sports, or girls, or NASCAR. I don't know what straight boys are into. But nobody expects the president of the science club to have a girlfriend. Actually, to be fair, I did have a girlfriend named Samantha in third grade, and yes, we kissed behind the old car at the end of the block, close-lipped, on the cheek. I showered in scalding water afterward. And despite the fact that I only truly liked her for the purple, fur-rimmed coat she wore on the playground, to the outside eye, I get that I was sending hetero cues on this one. But come on, the Trading Spaces thing is kind of hard to overlook. My family, I assume, concluded that I was a hapless, sensitive, straight soul who would marry some poor girl when I finally got the courage to talk to her sometime after my 40th birthday. And perhaps because I was a shy, chubby nerd who didn't like to talk about his feelings, I stayed in the closet through high school and well into college. I suppose a part of me was scared of what the reaction would be, but my family was never particularly conservative. We watched Will and Grace and Glee and all those shows on HGTV where most of the designers looked like they just got off a boat from Fire Island. Our boy dogs sometimes humped other boy dogs. And my family didn't have him immediately put down. In retrospect, the real reason I stayed in the closet for so long is that coming out is weird and personal and awkward and, yes, sex adjacent, and having that conversation with anybody, least of all my parents, was the last thing I wanted to do when I was already weird and awkward and easily embarrassed talking to people about anything vaguely intimate. The thought of having to one day admit, out loud, that I thought I'd maybe perhaps be interested in putting my penis inside another boy's penis, note, this is not how gay sex works, or what you're required to say when coming out, was downright terrifying. Besides, as a teenage boy already self-conscious about my weight, and my dorkiness, and my all-around social outcastness, I was afraid that coming out would usher in an era of unwelcome attention at a time when I wanted nothing more than to blend in. The only other out gay kid at our high school was a lesbian who called herself Madonna, and she was everything that terrified my teenage self. Loud and obnoxious and different and annoyingly confident. If I came out, I feared, I would become Madonna and gayness would define me. So I just didn't, and it was easy. I could look at gay posters on the internet and harbor real-life gay crushes and not have to worry about engaging in embarrassing conversations or attracting any unwanted notice. We lived in the suburbs, after all, which wasn't exactly crawling with other like-minded teenage boys to consummate my gayness with. In fact, the only other boy I was even vaguely interested in was the only other boy I regularly interacted with, One of the neighbor boys, likely an early indication of my predilection for soft-skinned Midwestern twinks with muscular calves who are good at baseball and swimming. But he was straight, and besides, I was a horny, red-blooded American boy, and I probably would have fallen in love with a pool noodle if it had slight pecs and asked me to hang out with it after school. God, this is going to make going home for Christmas awkward, isn't it? Someone from that family is going to listen to this book and make eye contact with me out of their kitchen window, and I'm going to have to be like, I'm sorry I admitted to being horny for you, your son, your brother. I was merely a child, and also he mooned me once as a joke between bros, so it's kind of his fault for turning on that particular light switch, if you know what I mean. So I went through high school perfectly content with keeping my gayness not necessarily secret, just not publicized. It wasn't until college when I met my straight best friend, the first boy I ever truly loved, and utterly destroyed our friendship with my inability to admit that I was perhaps in love with him in a way he couldn't reciprocate, that I finally felt the pressure to come out and put in the work. But let's start that story from the beginning. I met Kellen on the third day of our freshman year of college at a dining hall table of misfits. Note, Kellen is not his real name, but it is the name of a gay porn star I've seen, so we'll call him that to spare him scrutiny and also to further indulge my fantasies. By the third day of orientation, my given roommate, Troy, a wannabe frat boy with an outsized ego and zero game, having already decided I was a social liability, had ditched me for what he deemed a more lucrative social circle and left me to find dinner alone. I went to the dining hall by myself and walked with my tray to find an empty seat, presumably to plot how I'd spend the next 4 years in solitude. But I saw an open seat at a table full of guys I recognized from our dorm and asked if I could join. They said yes. There was Alex, a moppy-haired engineer who, by day three, had already fully embraced the shower-free, anti-deodorant, sweatpants, and flip-flops lifestyle of the college professional. Then Jared, a Chinese immigrant studying economics who always wore jeans that ended 4 inches above his ankles and who, I assume, is still wearing the same outfit as he manages some billion-dollar hedge fund on Wall Street. And finally, there was Kellen, Alex's roommate, tall and slender and boyish with smooth skin and bowl-cut hair and just the right amount of social anxiety to be approachable. He was beautiful in the same way that nerdy girls in 90s movies are beautiful, which is to say, he was one makeover montage away from being sweep off your feet hot, if he actually gave a shit about that kind of thing, but obviously he didn't because it was too awkward to make that happen. That night, we all became friends and ate dinner together for most nights after that. We studied together at night and played video games on the weekends and occasionally smuggled cheap vodka from the junior who lived down the hall to bring to football games, which was just an excuse to eat cheese fries and be underage drunk outdoors. A few months in, Alex joined a fraternity where his disheveled nature would find its true home, so we saw less of him, and Jared was often off on his own. He ate, no lie, approximately 7 meals a day, and the rest of us couldn't possibly keep up, so Kellen and I grew particularly close. One night, I mentioned I'd be leaving to go home for Thanksgiving, and Kellen let out a dramatic, "No!" And when I asked what was wrong, he said, "You can't leave. Then I'll have nobody to hang out with." And I felt warm and fuzzy and good about the fact that I'd found a friend who considered me his person, another boy who would genuinely miss me when I was gone and rejoice when I returned. Kellen was an only child, the son of wealthy parents who spent much of his childhood moving from private school to private school around the world. He'd spent the last several years in Texas, where he developed the slightest of southern twangs, but he was, in other words, someone who'd been similarly unaccustomed to deep friendships with other guys. We'd become friends largely out of chance, but we liked each other's company and worked well together. You can tell where this is going. It had only been like 2 months, and I was already wildly overreading the cues. I knew he was straight, don't get me wrong, but he was sensitive and endearing, and he actually liked hanging out with me. I'd never had a close guy friend before, not in adulthood, at least, let alone one who I kind of thought had a nice face and teeth and arms and butt, though I would never admit that even to myself. And he was a similarly intimacy-averse freak, so romantic rivals were largely out of the equation. In fact, we rarely talked about girls at all. I never mentioned that I was gay, although I'm sure it was obvious, and he never talked all that much about girlfriends, though I knew he'd had one in high school. And so it was easy to fall into a kind of imaginary romance without having to admit that's what was happening. And so we did everything together. Every morning, I would get ready and go to his room to collect him for breakfast. Sometimes I'd get there early because he'd be coming back from the shower and I could see him in his towel. On Christmas break, we'd chat online every day, and being the wildly insecure person I was, I'd often wait for him to chat me first so I knew he really wanted to talk, and then I'd obviously interpret that as a sign that he was somehow falling in love with me too. The summer after our freshman year, I flew to Houston to stay with him for a week, and we went to the mall and a baseball game and ate tacos, and we hugged at the airport before I flew home. And one night when we were both too drunk on Four Locos, before they were banned by the government, we passed out next to one another in his bed and drunkenly cuddled before falling asleep. It didn't take long into our sophomore year before I started expecting too much. Actually, that's the nice way of putting it. The truth is, I went crazy. I became obsessive and possessed. I was in love, but didn't want to admit that I was in love, not because I didn't want to admit that I was gay, but because I knew he wasn't, and I wanted our relationship to be the most it could be without us having to say it. We were just best friends, the closest of best friends, the closest you can possibly be to being gay for one another without actually being gay, because obviously neither of us is gay, we're just best friends. The tiny gay demon on my shoulder whispered in my ear and made me insane. I should note, the following behavior is embarrassing to admit, but it happened, and in the interest of full disclosure, I'm copping to all of it. These are the actions of a crazy person, and I am relaying them here so nobody makes the same mistakes as me. Kellen would want time alone to study, and I would insist on studying together. One day he would grab dinner without me, and I would spend 3 days passive-aggressively sulking in my room to teach him a lesson about what it was like to truly be without me. On nights when we'd get drunk on bottles of cheap champagne, I'd pretend to fall asleep on his bed, and he'd kick me out, and I'd drunkenly unfriend him on Facebook and send him a lengthy email the next day about how he didn't care about his friends. And, to be fair, he was sometimes a real insensitive asshole. We'd make up a couple of days later, and the cycle would start again. When he did start a fling with a girl in our dorm, a fact he kept to himself because, you know, we didn't talk about intimacy, and also because he probably knew I was becoming a crazy person, I pieced the clues together myself. Mutual hickeys spotted in the morning, disgustingly easy to notice, and demanded details, because that's what bros do, right? They tell each other things about girls, and what they like about girls, and why they like girls so much instead of boys. Friends tell each other everything, even things they don't tell the girls they're secretly hooking up with behind my back. And perhaps the craziest move, at the depths of my obsession, I wrote an actual essay for an actual class I was taking on Shakespeare using actual evidence from Shakespeare's plays to argue that friendships between dudes are stronger than sexual relationships between dudes and ladies. For real. I really did this. I used academia to convince myself and the world that two guys can have a totally normal and not gay bond that completely transcends the connection between any two human beings ever on Earth, and that it's not weird, and that it's totally not homosexual because Shakespeare said so. Craziness aside, though, that's a real goddamn theory, and it's called romantic friendship, and Shakespeare was all over that shit. Look it up. Stop this audiobook right now and go read As You Like It, and then you'll get what I'm talking about. They were totally in love with one another, and it totally wasn't gay, even though there's a bunch of theories today that are like, nuh-uh, gays didn't exist yet, so they were totally gay, they just didn't know it was called being gay yet. But you know what? Fuck those theories. I stand by my essay. I got a B+ on that shit. At the culmination of my obsession, I did the thing that I am most embarrassed to admit and cringe most to remember, and before I say it, I implore you to find it in your heart, to understand that it made perfect sense in my head at the time, and that the human brain does dumb things when it's in love, even if it refuses to admit that love is what it's feeling. At the time, there was a girl named Amber. Amber liked Kellen. Kellen liked Amber. They hooked up on the regular. It drove me insane. It wasn't exactly a secret, but they were both embarrassed about it. Straight people, always ashamed of their hookups. And, preferring to go unnoticed, denied it vehemently. Of course, being the crazy person I'd become, I insisted on confirmation, and Kellen insisted on denial, and I'd fall into a hole of exasperation and despair. It wasn't that he was hooking up with some girl, I'd tell myself. It was that he was lying to me about it, even though it was quite obviously that he was hooking up with some girl, and only a little bit that he was lying about it. One night, after we'd all been drinking together in Kellen's room, we'd said goodnight and went our separate ways. And then, here's where it gets embarrassing and fucked up and cringeworthy to even think about, I waited in the stairwell for approximately 3.5 minutes until I was confident Kellen had left his room to brush his teeth, a ritual he kept religiously every night, and having heard the clunk of the bathroom door, I quietly slunk back into his room, shut the door, and hid inside his closet. Now, I know what you're thinking. What the fuck is wrong with you, you gay stalker fuck? You're a grown-ass man who literally climbed inside his friend's closet to do what? Watch him sleep? Catch him masturbating? Fillet his skin into tiny bits of jerky? Or were you just trying to be the biggest cockblock you could possibly imagine? And the answer is, I don't know. I mean, definitely not the fillet thing, but still, I don't know. I was gay and crazy and infatuated and jealous and lonely and in denial. I wanted him to love me back. I wanted to be the one who snuck back into his room after everybody had gone away to tell secrets and make out and fall asleep side by side and sheepishly left in the morning before the rest of the dorm woke up. I suppose I figured he'd walk back in, and I'd jump out, and he'd scream so loud he'd turn gay, and then we'd laugh and laugh until we collapsed into one another's arms and fell softly into loving slumber. Of course, that's not at all what happened. These kinds of things never turn out the way you think they will. What happened next was something like this. I was sitting in the closet, questioning everything in my life that had led to that moment, and the person who walked into the room was not, in fact, Kellen, but Kellen's "we're definitely not hooking up, even though we totally are hooking up and lying about it to everybody, but especially Matt," hook up, Amber, who had come, I assume, to hook up. I froze. A closeted gay lunatic sitting on the ground of a literal closet. She didn't notice me. She made a phone call to her roommate to say she wouldn't be home that night. She hung up. We both sat in anticipation. When Kellen returned with his toothbrush, he screamed, "God damn it!" the second he opened the door, and for a brief, hopeful moment, I imagined he was pissed to see her, and I would emerge, triumphant, with a look on my face that said, "That's right, you pissworm, he chose me. Now get out, because we have some intense spooning to do." But his ire, it turned out, was directed at the 230-pound mass that was sticking out from his closet. Did I mention our dorm room closets were the size of small cupboards and covered in sheer curtains? Amber screamed when she realized I'd been in there, and they threw me out like they throw out drunks from bars in the movies, roughly, with one hand under each armpit. I'd like to think, at the very least, that I made their night together slightly more uncomfortable, but I suspect events continued as planned. In retrospect, this is what professionals in the therapy community might call a great big homosexual cry for help. But nothing much changed after that. I was a strange person to begin with, so hiding in a closet, all things considered, didn't register as insane, at least to the untrained eye, just immature and annoying and something drunk Matt would totally do because he's a weirdo. But deep down, I suspect, this was one of many moments when I began plotting my eventual escape into open gayness. At this point, I still hadn't said I was gay out loud to anyone except myself, which seems unbelievable since I was a 20-year-old man who listened to Lady Gaga, obsessively watched The Bachelorette, and purchased a set of martini glasses to make cosmopolitans in his dorm room. But fear is a powerful thing, and it convinces you that nobody could possibly know your glaringly obvious secret, and that you should keep it a secret because once you say it out loud, everything will be different. On top of the fear of having to have the awkward, intimate coming-out conversation with my family and the fear of my identity being co-opted by some gay stereotype, there was this new, extra fear of losing my best friend and the person I'd hoped would love me back. He came from a conservative Texas family, after all, and I'd already made it intensely awkward between us without voicing my deep, dark gay secret. What would he do once he knew that I was into dudes? Would all of my obviously gay advances register as too obviously gay to tolerate further? I suppose there was a part of me that saw Kellen as an opportunity to come out without having to actually come out. to just skip the awkward, personal, intimate part where you have to tell people you're gay and jump right to the part where you're getting gay married on a beach in Bora Bora, if only he'd love me back. But coming out is never that easy. The summer before our junior year of college, Kellen got a girlfriend and I felt like I was being replaced. My obsession deepened to its darkest point, and again, this is embarrassing to admit, but I stooped low and at one point surreptitiously borrowed his phone and glanced at his text messages, which seems like a totally normal thing for a best friend to do, right? But when you've already crossed about 1,000 boundaries, the other person is rightfully pissed. We didn't speak for a few weeks. I decided, finally, that if I ever hoped to have the type of relationship I really wanted with Kellen, like the one that he'd been developing with his new girlfriend, I had to do the thing. I had to come out and be gay and find gay people and do gay things and have faith that the consequences that I feared would be overcome by the rewards of my new fabulous life. And that's the thing about coming out. Before you do it, it feels very much like you're preparing for a kind of metamorphosis, that there will be a before gay and an after gay, and that things will be so massively different that you'll hardly recognize the life you had before. And it turns out, to a certain extent, that that's true. So I girded myself for impact. I read books with gay characters to see how they came out. I read It Gets Better because that felt like a thing young closeted gay people were supposed to read. I read articles I found on Google about the best way to come out to each person in your life. And finally, I did it. I wanted my mother to be the first to know because I knew she would be hurt if I told anybody else something so deeply personal before her. I wrote her a letter because a letter felt like the easiest and also most dramatic way to do this kind of thing, and I wasn't about to let an opportunity for theatrics go to waste. I don't remember exactly what the letter said, but I think it was something like, "Sorry I ruined a perfectly good set of sheets in the eighth grade. It was because of the shirtless picture of Nick Lachey I saw in the Us Weekly you left on the kitchen counter." I cried, and I'm not sure why, because I wasn't sad, but I guess you just cry during these things because it's emotional. Of course, my mother said she loved me and would always love me, and she just wanted me to be happy. And to top it off, one of the first things she asked me was, "Is Kellen your boyfriend?" And I had to fucking say no. About a week later, I wrote to Kellen and confessed that I was gay, that that's why I'd been so emotional lately, that I was sorry for being a weirdo and hiding in his closet and going through his phone, that he was my best friend and I just wanted to know he would still be my friend no matter what. And, like a good, normal friend, he told me I'd still be the same Beyoncé-loving, Gaga-praising Matt as before, that nothing would change between us. Of course, coming out wouldn't change the fact that I was still secretly obsessed with Kellen, even if I tried desperately to deny it. A few days after I told him, I wrote a Facebook message to our group of friends to announce my news, and the following is an absolutely real excerpt from that message. I cringe to reread this message, not to mention publish it for the world to see, but nothing better illustrates the anxieties of my gay brain than these words. Here is that message, edited only for length. "Hey friends, so I have news. I've been doing a lot of soul searching this month. Haha, not really, I'm just really bored at work, and I have something important to tell y'all, and I could really use your support. Here it is. Hey look, a bunny! I'm gay. No really, did you see it? It was a really big bunny. Like, lots of fur and everything. Could have been a big squirrel even. Not really sure. Oh well, it's gone. You missed it." Phew. Now that the squirrel bunny's gone, yeah, I like dudes. I've always known it. You kind of just know these things. I've known long before I met all of you, but I never told anybody, not my family or friends or anybody, because I was afraid of what everybody would think. I guess I was most afraid that it would suddenly be the only thing people would see about me. I was afraid I would suddenly become the gay kid in the group. And even if you all had absolutely no problem with me, you would still joke about dicks and assholes and rainbows all the time, and I would never hear the end of it, so please don't do that. And for the record, in case anybody wants to know, I don't have a thing for Kellen, haha, and I never have. Even though I always poke and grab his tiny white butt, I don't want to hit that. It's a nice butt, don't worry, Kel. Nothing to be ashamed of, just not my thing. It's truly always been meaningless joking. He's my bestie and nothing more. I don't care if I hug him or sleep over in his room or give him a big wet kiss on the cheek. I still don't want his dick, so don't give a shit, got it? Anyway, that's what I've been up to. Now, if anybody is interested, once we're all together, we can throw a fabulous coming out party full of foo-foo drinks and Beyonce. Presents are always welcome, and so help me God, if anybody gets me anything phallus-shaped, I will not be happy. Well, maybe a little happy. Love, 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 Maddie B. Alright, there's a lot to unpack here. First of all, the most surprising thing in this entire message is that I was so anxious about being seen as gay that I went so far as to deny myself the pleasure of getting phallus-shaped gifts. See, the thing about coming out is that there is an after-gay. Things do change, but you start to love it. You start to realize that those pleasures you'd been denying yourself were what would have made you happy all along. Now, several years after this entire mess, the only gifts I will accept are dildos, and I'm profoundly offended if anybody dares to associate me with anything but dicks, assholes, and rainbows. They are deeply entwined in my identity, and I cannot imagine life without them. But of course, that's hardly the focus of this message. As is painfully obvious to me now, and was painfully obvious to all who read this letter, the only appropriate response to this disaster of a message is, okay, so you're obviously madly in love with Kellen, and clearly want him to fuck babies into you. O.J. Simpson could have written a more convincing denial than this. Birds could have picked up the hints I was dropping. I mean, come on! I barely made it 200 words before bringing his ass into it. It doesn't get any gayer than that. And so I replaced one thinly veiled secret for another, and after gay life began in much the same denial that before gay life had ended. It didn't take long into our senior year for my obsession to reach its inevitable climax. One night, we went out drinking, we came back, I pretended to pass out in his bedroom, he yelled at me to leave, I turned it into this whole thing about how he clearly didn't want to be my friend anymore because he had a girlfriend and because I was gay, and if that's how he was going to act, then maybe we should just break up, and I dramatically unfriended him on Facebook for one last time and sent him an email the next day saying it was probably best that we just didn't see each other again. It was silly and dumb, I know, but when you finally release the gay feelings you've been bottling up for 20 years, a few other emotions are bound to come pouring out with the rest. It's a lot like using a plunger to get a hairbrush from the toilet hole. Sure, you'll get your hairbrush back, but that thing's gonna bring some shit back with it. And I wouldn't exactly use it to brush your hair. Kellen was my first true love, and I regret that the gay demon inside of me ruined it all. I'm thankful in many ways that I learned enough about myself to know I needed to come out sooner rather than later, that being openly gay was not only an inevitability, but a wonderful thing that I would not only come out of the closet, but come out of my shell and find my true voice. Of course, I'd like to think that I simply had no choice but to martyr our friendship to make this discovery, but I know that's not true. The sad lesson here, children, if you haven't yet written me off as a complete sociopath, is that falling in love with your straight best friend is perhaps the worst, most self-destructive idea you could possibly have, because not only will they never love you back in the same way you love them, they'll serve as a constant reminder that you are putting off the thing you should have done years ago but cannot escape. And the only thing worse than your straight best friend not loving you back is spending 3 years chasing after his affection when you know full well it will never happen. I spent the rest of my senior year of college going to gay bars in Boys Town and drinking pitchers of hard pink lemonade out of straws bent to look like giant dicks. I talked to boys and traded numbers and did all the things that grown gay people are supposed to do. Buy meth. After college, I moved to New York, the gayest city in the world, and the first place I'd go where nobody knew any version of me besides the one that was perfectly openly gay. I have yet to terrorize a boy quite like I terrorize Kellen. And if he happens to be listening to this, I should say I'm sorry for, you know, basically everything. But the sappy part of me would like to believe that crazy closeted Matt is gone, and in his place is someone far happier, and far less likely to hide in your closet. On relationships, or traits for my ideal man. I'm most definitely not an expert on relationships. In fact, I'm like the opposite of an expert, as all evidence presented in these pages should prove. People have actually begged me not to comment on relationships for fear that I'm capable of causing more harm than good. And it's true. The only real relationship I've had in the 5 years I've spent in New York City was the one I had with the man who delivered my Indian food. He came to my apartment almost every other day, gave me my food, and walked away, leaving only an aura of mystery, sensuality, and a chicken tikka masala dinner special with basmati rice and vegetable samosas. But here's where it got really special, and where I gained the confidence I needed to really dominate this whole relationship thing. About a year into our takeout-fueled flirtations, Indian delivery guy started slipping a little extra something into my bag. And that little extra something was a free rice pudding. Now, if I was actually good at relationships, I would have vocalized my feelings better by kindly explaining that I'm more of an ice cream person and think rice pudding has the consistency of cold phlegm. But I appreciated the gesture, and it broke my heart when I moved away from that apartment, never to see Indian delivery guy again. For all he knows, I died, choking on a clump of his free rice pudding. Alas, having been through the intensity of a New York relationship, I know now what I require from a lover and life partner, and have decided to list those requirements on the off chance that someone listening to this book may fit the requirements or know someone who does. Traits for landing my hand in marriage, or at least getting me to eat in front of you. 1. Can sing with the emotional spirit of a wounded dove and is willing to sing me to sleep every night. 2. Has skin that is soft like the hair of a freshly washed puppy or the underside of a very old toad. 3. Can build a treehouse using only his bare hands, 3 screws, a shovel, and the hopes and dreams of a nation. 4. Can bake an entire 3-tier cake, frost it, write an uplifting message on it, and then eat it all in under an hour. 5. Has the ability, when I'm angry, to soothe me with only a series of whispers and clicks, like he's calming a spooked horse. 6. Is willing to sing with me at karaoke, but must pretend to be a worse singer than I am, even if he can sing like a wounded dove, and also he must cry when I hit the high notes and pretend like I nail them every single time. 7. Knows how to make pasta with his bare hands, and also is maybe good enough to open his own restaurant and name it after me and have a picture of me hanging in the kitchen so when he's old and I'm dead from a carbohydrate overdose, he can stare into my face and remember the times we spent laughing together with mouthfuls of his homemade tagliatelle. 8. Rides a bike to work, but isn't all fancy about it. 9. Is willing to read me bedtime stories upon request. 10. Has a psychic ability to tell when I need coffee and is able to supply it instantly when necessary. 11. Sweats only to the point where it's sexy and not to the point where it's all gross and gummy and starts to pool. 12. Knows how to accurately age any wheel of cheese with only a single sniff. 13. Is capable of physically bearing our children in his lush womb. 14. Has hair that isn't too long, but long enough to flow in the wind like the strands on a majestic wildebeest running in the African plains. 15. Can play the guitar, but never does because one mere stroke of his strings has been said to bring the chilliest of men to irrepressible tears. 16. Capable of wearing a t-shirt and no bottoms without looking like a rampaging pedophile, which is a nearly impossible look to pull off. I mean, have you ever seen a man with just a shirt on? It's horrifying almost always. 17. Can prepare an entire Thanksgiving dinner alone and feed it to me using only one giant spoon. 18. Can talk to birds, but only to shut them up when they start doing all their bird shit too early in the morning. 19. Can live with someone who will inevitably develop irritable bowel syndrome if he hasn't already and have an unhesitating willingness to clean the bathroom on his own whenever necessary, which will be more necessary than most humans would consider normal. 20. brings me donuts when he goes running in the morning, because I'm sure as fuck not gonna get up and go running in the morning, and not just any donuts, but the warm kind from the good place that we went to that one time but whose name I can't remember. 21. Lets me dictate who is Big Spoon and Little Spoon every single time with no protest. 22. Brings me free rice pudding. On the sticky perils of having a roommate. When I was maybe 3 or 4 years old, my mother thought it would be a good idea to move my bed into my brother's room and combine our bedrooms into one. That's the thing about having children. You can do these little experiments on them, moving bedrooms and shaking up the social order, and the only consequence is lifelong psychological damage. The reason, at least on its face, was to have a separate room just for toys and games and activities, but I think secretly, her aim was to facilitate bonding between my brother and me. Brothers who sleep in the same room must, she naively thought, grow in unspeakable fellowship. I was too young to care all that much, but my brother, who is 6 years older, found the entire arrangement utterly unacceptable, as he should have, if we're being honest, and conspired against it from its very inception. On the first night, just after my mother kissed us goodnight, turned out the lights, and shut the door, and just as she walked to her own room, admiring her success, my brother sat up in his bed and began whispering a string of terrifying mumblings in my direction. He warned me of clowns that would kill me in my sleep, and werewolves that would devour the remains, and in the morning there would be only a pile of blood and bones left for Mom and Dad to find in my stead. I lay there with my eyes as open as they could be, staring at the ceiling, wondering how exactly the clowns would kill me, and if I would feel anything while the werewolves tore my limbs apart, and whether Mom and Dad would scream when they found what was left of me, and finally, I let out a shriek. My brother quickly fell into a sleeping position, and my mother came running back to find my shivering body in a cold sweat for apparently no reason, unable to speak. This went on, uninterrupted, for at least 7 whole nights, until finally my mother realized her experiment had failed and relented, pushing my bed back into its room and restoring the rightful balance. But of course, the damage had been done. Perhaps because of this, I have always placed precious value on my personal space. I rather like having my own bedroom and spent most of my childhood cultivating a sanctuary. And indeed, I made it all the way to college before ever having to think about sharing my bedroom with another person again. In fact, avoiding having a roommate was a reason I considered not going to college at all. The idea of having to compromise a fundamental part of my worldview for the sake of education was almost too much to handle. As most college freshmen are, I was randomly assigned a roommate by an old computer with a terrible sense of irony and humor. Sure, we were told to fill out surveys to gauge our lifestyle preferences, checking boxes like, I like a clean room, I like to listen to music while I study, and I will not stand over my roommate in the middle of the night and whisper lyrics to Whitney Houston's greatest hits. But I'm convinced those surveys were simply a tactic to keep us from rioting when we discovered we'd been matched with someone whose lifestyle preferences were practically the polar opposite of our own. A few months before the school year was set to begin, I got an email announcing I'd been matched with a Troy and promptly found him on Facebook, which revealed nothing beyond the fact that he was graduating from some preparatory private high school in one of the wealthier Chicago suburbs and was also named Troy. When I walked in on moving day, Troy had already moved all of his belongings into the room, which appeared to be nothing more than a laptop, 2 thin pillows, and a duvet, which he was sitting atop, his parents on either side of him, all of them in stern silence. They had the appearance of parents who prized stellar grades and nothing else. Troy sat at attention between them. He was a little shorter than me, but smaller in size, with slight muscles hugging his high school t-shirt. He had hair closely cropped to his head and a sort of blank-looking face, like he was already over it all. "Hey, I'm Matt," I said. "Nice to meet you." But before I could get any further, my family came bounding in with boxes, bins, and baskets overflowing with clothes, food, and furniture, my mother barking directions about what would go where before she'd even fully entered the room. There were some 8 or 9 family members who came as part of my entourage, and they worked like an assembly line, carting in the mini-fridge, hanging clothes, making the bed, disinfecting the carpet, and constructing shelving units that would hold all of the shit I'd brought with me, all while Troy's family looked on in stunned wonder. By the time they finished, my half of the room looked like a Bed Bath & Beyond catalog had exploded. Troy's half of the room looked even more depressing in contrast. We'd only managed to exchange a handful of words, and already I was worried I was making the impression that I was some type of high-maintenance mama's boy, which was technically true, just not something I was eager to advertise 20 minutes into our introduction. That night, after my circus of a family left and Troy's parents silently slipped away, we went to the dining hall with a handful of other dorm mates, and I started piecing together Troy's persona. He'd wanted to go to another school, he told the group, but got stuck with this one. He wanted to live in another dorm, but they stuck him with this too. With each new answer, it became increasingly clear that he was trying aggressively hard to seem cool. I was waiting for him to point at me and say, I asked for a straight albino Jamaican, but they stuck me with you. But that never came. After dinner, we wandered as a group around campus, hoping perhaps to stumble upon some party. Troy became our group's de facto leader, and we followed him aimlessly before realizing he had no idea where he was going. Eventually, we all wandered back to the dorm. That night, after we'd each gotten in bed, he asked me if I was rushing a fraternity. The only thing I knew about fraternities was what I saw in movies. Innocent freshmen standing naked in kiddie pools full of jello, humiliating themselves because a bunch of old dudes did the same thing before them. All to live in a grimy old house with 50 other disgusting guys whose room smelled consistently like burnt ramen and soggy cereal. Besides, I'd never heard the term rushing before, except in the literal sense. I pictured an army of small-muscled freshmen running at an old frat house with lances and spears like in Lord of the Rings. No? I guessed out loud. I mean, I thought about rushing, obviously, but I don't think it's for me. Are you? I could hear him sigh, presumably because he'd gotten his final confirmation that we just weren't going to work out. I don't even think he answered. In the days that followed, Troy and I gave up all pretenses that we were anything beyond 2 random people who happened to share the same 200 square feet of bedroom. He made his friends and I made mine, but we'd still occasionally find ourselves at the same dining hall table, and I'd gradually piece together the real Troy. Troy clearly aspired to the stereotypical college boy cliche. Party at night, nab some drunk freshman and convince her to give him a depressing hand job in a shower stall, stumble back to the beer pong table, give a bunch of his dude friends high fives, and eventually pass out in the bushes somewhere behind fraternity row. That was the image he projected, at least, but I knew the real Troy, which made his phony frat boy image all the more insufferable. For one, he asked me one day a couple months into our year together whether girls could sleep in my bed when I wasn't there. I went home every other weekend because I was cool and left behind a perfectly empty bed. So Troy asked, if I wasn't there, could any of his lady friends use my bed? Of course, the bro thing to do would have been to say, yes, of course your strange drunken conquest can totally sleep on my Egyptian cotton 1200 thread count Nate Berkus bedsheets. That's what I bought them for. But I couldn't get over the image of some blasted freshman throwing up on my memory foam pillows the second Troy pulled down his pants. Besides, I wondered, why would someone as ostensibly accomplished with the opposite sex need a separate bed to store his concubines? I wasn't exactly roping an ass myself, but I knew, generally speaking, that sleeping in the same bed was typically part of the deal. So I said no. I'd rather he didn't let anybody sleep in my bed while I was away, or sit on it, or even look at it, because the fabric was too delicate for anybody whose skin composition didn't exactly match mine. He resented me for denying his request, and I resented him for making the request in the first place, ensuring that every time I returned from a weekend away, I'd be forced to sniff my pillows for sweaty residue left by some intoxicated skank. In any case, I never saw Troy with a girl, which was fine by me, but blew in the face of his air of utter superiority and the clear importance he put on his sexual domination. He'd brag about the women he'd met at this party or that, but as far as I could tell, nothing ever came of it. Of course, I'm not judging the lack of sex. I spent most of my college nights eating shitty pizza, playing video games, and crushing on straight boys from inside the closet. Troy just got on my goddamn nerves, like a hangnail I was forced to live with, a nagging discomfort that grew more and more unbearable each day. I started begrudging the way he smacked while he ate, the pungent smell of his deodorant after he came back from the shower, and his never-ending cough, a dull that I thought was from a simple cold when we first moved in, but that persisted day after day for the entire year, a constant every 15 minutes until I couldn't stand it anymore. One Friday night in the spring of our freshman year, I'd just turned off all the lights and gotten into bed. It was a little after midnight and I was alone and just about to fall asleep when I heard Troy fumbling with his keys at the door. It was taking longer than usual, and when he finally pushed the door open with a final thud, I could tell he was drunk, the smell of vodka filling the room.
"Oh, shit,"
I heard him whisper to himself when he noticed I was in bed. I rolled my eyes in the dark as he struggled to take off his shoes, knocking over a stack of books on his desk. I could hear as he wriggled out of his shirt, wrestled off his pants, the sound of his belt buckle jangling in my ear, and finally plopped down on his bed. Our beds sat parallel to one another on opposite sides of the room against facing walls, some 8 feet apart, side to side. My back was turned to him, but I could see the wall in front of me light up as he opened his laptop in the dark, the glow of the screen casting a pale glare across the room. I tried to ignore the clacking of the typing, the whir of the computer fan, the "huh" of his coughs. He'd been on his computer before while I was sleeping, his back against the wall opposite me. But this time, the typing suddenly stopped. And then I heard it. The faint sounds of moaning emanating from headphones. The unmistakable whimpers of some poor actress whose dreams had been so different once long ago, who was left with no choice but to groan her way through a video that ended up in the bowels of the internet and eventually on the laptop of some college boy who drunkenly stumbled home after striking out for the 100th night in a row, but was nevertheless determined to release whatever pressure he'd spent the evening bringing upon himself. Her muted screams punctuated the room like a tiny subway train screeching along its tracks. "Oh no," I thought to myself, my eyes wide open, staring into the white of the wall in front of me. "This isn't happening." And then, there it was, the distinct sound of palm stroking lotioned flesh, the sound of a wooden spoon mixing a bowl of creamy macaroni and cheese, radiating from Troy's lap. I lay there in dazed silence, unsure how to process what was happening behind me, or why it was happening, or how to get it to stop. Now, I certainly don't profess to be an expert at college masturbation or its protocols, and I certainly don't profess to understand the first thing about straight men or their curious behaviors or what exactly they feel comfortable doing in the presence of other men. But I do feel confident enough in my own extensive experience on the subject to point out that there does exist a set of unspoken norms to which all college men implicitly agree, and at the risk of betraying its unspoken nature, they are as follows. Always knock before entering a room, or at the very least, flounder with your keys at the door for a few seconds to signal that you're about to enter. If possible, post your schedule in public view so your dorm fellow might better understand which times you'll be away and when you might return. Avoid shower masturbation as it puts strain on dorm plumbing. And by all means, and this one should really, truly go without saying, keep your dick in your pants when another person is in the room, be they unconscious or otherwise. Perhaps it was my mistake for not laying out these rules more explicitly, I wondered as I lay there motionless, plotting my next move. Maybe I should have gotten Troy to sign some sort of self-pleasure contract, or at least offhandedly mentioned once or twice that I'd appreciate it if he wouldn't lotion up his lap snake while I was lying a couple arm lengths away. But there we were. The moans of his chosen film's protagonist struggling to overcome the squish, squish, squish of her viewer's strokes. He was making no apparent attempt to hide the fact that this was happening, either so enraptured by his task or so convinced that I was dead asleep across from him. His confidence made me wonder if this had happened before, if perhaps I'd been snoring through night after night of this and had no idea. And sure, while this entire incident sounds like the beginning of every gay porn ever filmed, I still wanted it to end. Nobody wants a masturbating dick they didn't ask for, especially not one that's attached to a vodka-soaked wannabe heartbreaker with a chronic cough. I'm not one for confrontation, or for awkward encounters, or really for any interactions of any kind. I certainly wasn't about to let him finish, but I couldn't imagine sitting up, looking at him dead in his stupid slack-jawed face, and telling him to unhand his sausage. So I did the easiest thing at my disposal. I let out a loud, prominent cough, accompanied by some light stirring and grumbling. Not quite an ahem, but a discernible enough action to send the message, I am awake, I hear everything, please sheathe your penis. Momentarily, the squishing stopped, and I heard the tapping of his finger on the volume keys as he lowered the sound of the moaning video. There was silence, and I stirred again, just to say, yep, I'm totally awake. Let's just everybody put their penises away, and we can get on with pretending this never happened. The silence lasted, and I let out a sigh that we'd solved the problem swiftly and amicably, with no seed being needlessly spilt. But the silence lasted only 20 seconds. There came again the tap-tap-tap of the volume returning to its previous level, the moans resumed breathlessly from his headphones, and the accompanying squish-squish-squish carried on with renewed vigor. Oh my God! I screamed in my head. Now what? Still determined to solve this without having to actually acknowledge that I'd been awake this whole time, I took drastic action. I started to roll over. Until then, I'd been steadfastly facing the wall, giving Troy all the privacy of my turned back. But surely, if I turned to face him, even with my eyes still closed, he'd have to stop. No man in his right mind would take that kind of risk. And so I rolled, more dramatically than I normally would, grumbling and fumbling like an old man looking for the glasses atop his head, coughing for extra measure to indicate full alertness. When I finally landed on my other side, facing Troy's direction, I noticed he'd stopped yet again. Frozen, I imagined, like a deer in the glow of his laptop. For 5 whole minutes, there was nothing but the sound of the whirring computer fan and the occasional click of his touchpad. Glorious silence. I started to focus on falling asleep, wondering how I'd recount this story at breakfast tomorrow. But sure enough, the subtle moans rang out again, and the squish, squish, squish continued, now more strenuously than before, like he was rushing to get it over with, angry at having been interrupted. Finally, I rolled onto my back and stretched out my arms above me, letting out an obnoxious yawn like I was stirring myself from a particularly good dream but wasn't quite awake. This had to end, but I still refused to acknowledge that I was fully awake, intent as I was on avoiding the awkwardness as much as possible. And so I leaned forward, pretending to be half asleep, and reached into the mini fridge for a bottle of water, which I opened and chugged unpleasantly. If convincing him I was awake wasn't enough, I figured, maybe my slobbering would kill his libido entirely. Meanwhile, Troy had shifted his pillows to obstruct his exposed flap, and the squishing had abated. I maintained the pretense of being half asleep, fully vertical in bed with the bottle of water still dripping on my lap, but my eyes still closed. I made an exaggerated effort to reach for my cell phone and lay back down, facing the wall, with my phone illuminated against my face. There would be no mistaking now that I was awake. Defeated, I heard Troy shift on his sheets, pulling his boxers back up, and then the sound of him stumbling toward the door and down to the bathroom, presumably to complete whatever business he had to attend to. Vindicated, I turned off my phone, and in beautiful silence, I was able to finally fall asleep. In the days that followed, Troy gave off very little indication that he knew what had happened, or at least managed to convince himself he'd been stealthier than he had been. Though, of course, I wouldn't expect him to walk in and say, hey, that was crazy last night, wasn't it? But it would have been nice to detect at least a hint of shame in place of his typical bravado. I didn't hesitate repeating the story to my friends the next morning. The almighty ladies' man, Troy, staggering home on a Friday night, drunk and rejected, vigorously massaging his neglected manhood. I happily admitted to being the unwitting dope in this story, if only to expose Troy and his shameless, semi-public masturbating. One afternoon, not long after the night of the incident, Troy stopped me in our room, a rare moment of communication. "My parents are coming this weekend," he said. "They want to take us out to..."